From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Singer Lena Horne died Sunday at the age of 92. She got her start at the Cotton Club at 16, and she was the first black performer to be signed to a long-term contract by a major Hollywood studio. But she hated Hollywood. Her favorite job was singing at the Integrated Cafe Society outside of Harlem. It was there she met Paul Robeson, who became a major influence on her career. We'll hear from her daughter, journalist Gail Lumette Buckley, who wrote about her family in the book The Horns. Also, actor Woody Harrelson. His film The Messenger is out on DVD next week. It's about soldiers who visit family members to tell them a loved one has died in combat. We'll talk about that and his other movie roles. And film critic David Edelstein reviews Mother and Child. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Singer and actress Lena Horne died Sunday in New York at the age of 92. She blazed a trail in Hollywood in the 1940s as the first black performer to sign with a major studio. But despite her talents, she was relegated mostly to non-speaking singing roles that could be cut out of films for Southern audiences. Horne became a popular performer for U.S. troops during World War II and had a successful career recording and performing in nightclubs. Here's a Cole Porter song from her first MGM movie, Panama Hattie.
It was just one of those things, just one of those crazy things, one of those bells that now and then ring, just one of those things. It was just one of those nights, just one of those fabulous flights, a trip to the moon on gossamer wings, just one of those things. If we thought a bit of the end of it before we started painting the town, we'd have been aware that our love affair was too hot not to cool down. So goodbye, dear, and amen.
That's Lena Horne from the 1942 film Panama Hattie. Today we'll listen back to a 1986 interview Terry recorded with Lena Horne's daughter, Gail Lumet Buckley. They spoke when Buckley had written her book, The Hornes, An American Family, which was the basis for an American Masters documentary on PBS. The book traces her family history from slavery to the move north, where they became one of the most prosperous and influential black families of Harlem and Brooklyn. They worked on behalf of civil rights and women's rights and advocated education for the advancement of blacks. Those intellectual and social family traditions were broken by Lena's father, who made his money gambling and running numbers. Terry began by asking Lumet about Lena Horne's parents, who were regarded as the black sheep of the family.
What did your grandparents do to earn the reputation of black sheep?
Well, my grandfather, theoretically, this is family history. We hope it's true, or at least I hope it's true because it's fun, made a killing in the Black Sox scandal of 1921, the baseball fix. He certainly suddenly had a lot of money in 1921 and ran off to Seattle that year, ran away from his wife and his three-year-old daughter, Lena. And he was away out of her life for a long time. Shortly thereafter, her mother left her to go on the stage. And this was unheard of, because her mother had also been brought up in the bosom of the bourgeoisie. The only career that a black bourgeois woman could accept honorably was teaching. When they did work, they taught, or social work. And to go on the stage was tantamount to prostitution.
So your mother ended up getting shuttled back and forth between relatives in the South and in the North.
Yes, she did. She was initially brought up by her grandmother in Brooklyn, the wonderful Cora Calhoun, feminist and suffragette. And then her mother decided, I want this child back. And she didn't really want the child. She just wanted to make her mother-in-law mad, it turns out, because she would be touring in these tent shows in the South and would leave little Lena with whoever happened to be around while she'd go off. And so my mother created a sort of dual personality for herself, her Southern personality when she'd go to one-room schoolhouses, and the kids made fun of her accent and her skin color. And then the other personality that she'd have to, which was her real personality when she'd go back to her grandmother and to Brooklyn and her friends in Brooklyn.
So in a way, she was really a perpetual outsider
as
a child.
Yes, she was. She was an outsider, both in the middle class in a way, even though those were her roots, and certainly with poorer blacks among whom she lived, but did not really belong.
How did your mother start in show business?
Well, she'd done amateur theatrics in clubs, in her various little clubs in Brooklyn, the Junior Debs, they were called. She wanted to sing and dance. Her mother, she'd always had dancing and singing lessons. And she'd done amateur theatrics. And when her grandmother died, her mother decided, I'm going to put this girl on the stage. She's pretty and she's talented. Let's see what happens. So at 16, she was put into the Cotton Club.
your grandfather provided protection, so to speak, for her when she was playing in these clubs that were frequently run by the mob.
Yes, absolutely. Dutch Schultz's mob protected her in the Cotton Club because he was very close to Dutch Schultz's black numbers men.
Well, you write that when she was 19, she had no boyfriends because her mother really wanted her to focus on the stage and not to be distracted. What happened to her when she married young? What happened to her career?
Well, she assumed that she was going to retire. And then shortly after I was born, a call came from Hollywood, a quickie. All-black musical film was being produced in Hollywood. And some people who had seen her in the Cotton Club said, come and do this show, or this movie, without auditioning or anything. And she was not the same slim creature she'd been in the Cotton Club. She just had a baby. And she arrived, and they were sort of disappointed. But nevertheless, she made the movie. It was called The Duke is Tops. Then when she became a star, they renamed it to Bronze Venus and made her the star. It was still the same movie. It was a sort of backstage romance, very innocuous story. And so that was sort of a dip into show business. Then she got another call after she finished that movie to be in a Blackbirds show, Blackbirds of 1939, which was a flop. But when it opened on Broadway, it only lasted about 7 performances. She got wonderful reviews from the New York Times, and all the columnists noticed her.
Your mother spent some time touring with the Charlie Barnett Band, and they'd tour through the South and run into all kinds of segregation problems. Did she ever consider trying to pass for white during that period?
She never did, though people earlier in her career and later in her career, all through her career in the early stages, people had suggested, and she always refused.
Since she was the granddaughter of people who had been very important in the black bourgeoisie in New York, did she feel that it was okay for her to be in show business or music? Did she feel like she was violating the family tradition in any way? Now, we'd spoken about how her father ended up being, your grandfather ended up being a numbers runner and gambler, and your grandmother, her mother, wanted her to be on the stage. So for her parents, show business would have been fine.
Great. No, it was fine. But for her grandparents, her grandmother would have been horrified if she'd been alive. She wanted to be a teacher. She was going to be a teacher. That was all set. Even though she did encourage the music lessons, because this was all right. Bourgeois children were exposed to culture, as it were.
Was she guilty about that?
I don't think so. I think she was very interested in her career. I think she was serious about it. She had to make money. And this was the middle of the Depression when she was starting all this. And I think she had ambition. She really wanted to make it.
After some of the performances that you mentioned, like the Lou Leslie's Blackbirds of 1939, she for a while sang at Cafe Society.
Yes, that was her favorite job she ever had, so she says.
Describe what was so special about the club.
Well, it was a special place. It was very much as, I called it a seminar with drinks. Barney Josephson was an old line socialist pacifist who wanted to start a nightclub. It was the first integrated nightclub in New York outside of Harlem, where both the patrons and a few jazz spots would allow black customers in. But the policy was integration. The policy was no fancy, no fake palm trees, no cigarette girls. It was all very much, it was very left-wing, very intellectually stimulating, and everybody important who was black went there, and everybody important who was white went there. So it was a fabulous meeting ground. And this is where my mother met friends of her uncles and friends of her parents, not her parents particularly, but her grandparents, people who knew them, and especially of her uncle Frank, who were people who had become very important in her life, like Paul Robeson.
And a lot of intellectuals and writers hung out there.
Yeah.
So I guess.
And great performers. I mean, Billie Holiday, Teddy Wilson, Compton and Green.
So it's one of the places in her life where her entertaining career and her family background came together.
Came together, absolutely. Probably the only place where it really came together so neatly. And she was very happy there. And she got wonderful reviews. And it was where her career really began, because it was from there that she was asked to come to Hollywood to open a new nightclub. And when she did that, that was the beginning of her Hollywood career.
I thought it was interesting the way Bonnie Josephson suggested changes in her repertoire when she was singing in Cafe Society. Would you explain that?
Yes, and she auditioned for Barney. She first started singing Sleepy Time Down South, and he said, no, no, you can't sing that song. Don't you know what they do to black people in the South? So she said, oh, I'm sorry. And then she started singing a song called Down Argentina Way. He said, no, no, you can't sing that. There were all these girls in Brooklyn who were changing their name and pretending to be Latin. You've got to be yourself. You've got to be real. Who are you? And she said, gosh, I don't know. So Barney's a wonderful guy, maintains that he sort of taught her what to sing and how to sing it in a way.
And he suggested she just sing standards.
He said, sing standards and sing the blues, sing one blues. And she said, I can't sing the blues. She'd never sang the blues. The black bourgeoisie did not approve of the blues. And he said, nonsense, sing Billy's Blues, which is Billie Holiday's song. And she just was so nervous about it and felt she couldn't do it. So she went to talk to Billie Holiday, who said, do you have two children to take care of? Do you, you know, so you can just sing it and don't worry about anything else. She was a wonderful woman, sad, wonderful woman, but she was very good to my mother.
Gail Lumet Buckley speaking with Terry Gross about her mother, Lena Horne, who died Sunday. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're listening to Terry's 1986 interview with Gail Lumet Buckley. Her mother, Lena Horne, died Sunday.
When your mother, Lena Horne, signed her MGM contract, she was, as you describe her, the first glamorous black star in Hollywood. So, I mean, before her, what could
well,
black
you
star
played domestics or you played jungle extras. She was also the first long-term contract ever given a black player in Hollywood. And she was Walter White and Paul Robeson's test case. She was a test case to the NAACP, which had decided they were going to change the image of Hollywood. It was World War II. Okay, you know, we're supposed to be fighting for democracy. Let's do it at home. And this was part of this program. And she was it. She was the test case. And that made her the enemy of a lot of black actors in Hollywood who were very upset. And they said, you're trying to take work away from us. There'll be no more jungle movies. There'll be no more old plantation movies. What are you trying to do? And Paul Robeson said to her, these people aren't important. The people who matter are out there, the Pullman porters, those people. And they want to see a new image. And you've got to do it. She said, okay.
So what did Paul Robeson want your mother to do?
Wanted her to refuse to play a domestic, to refuse to play any role that was demeaning to blacks, and to stick by that and not be swayed from it.
Did she have any doubts about taking on this?
Well, she did. She did, and she went back to New York and kind of very upset. I mean, it had all been so fast.
It's quite a responsibility.
It's an incredible responsibility, and she'd been this sort of overnight huge success in the Hollywood nightclub. She'd auditioned for Louis B. Mayer, who'd said, yes, sign her up instantly. And, of course, the first role that they screen-tested her for was for a maid part. So they were really kind of trying to get out of it. They weren't taking it very seriously. But Robeson and Walter White were taking it seriously, and she was taking it seriously. And her father, Teddy Horne the gambler, came out to Hollywood, flew out very dapper and demanded an interview very politely with Louis B. Mayer and said, I can afford to hire a maid for my daughter. She doesn't need to play a maid. And they were bowled over by this. They'd never seen anything like Teddy Horne or heard anything like that from a black man who was not political anyway.
Did they know about his affiliation
with
gangsters?
They knew nothing about him except that he was incredible. He wore handmade shoes and sulca ties, and he walked in and spoke very coolly and quietly and said he wasn't going to let his daughter do anything that was undignified. So they had the family coming at them from one end, and Paul Robeson and Walter White of the NAACP from the other end. And they were stuck with doing the right thing.
So did she get roles? Were there roles for her?
There were no roles. There were never roles. And my mother always just had was sort of in a part because all her part scenes were cut out of the South. In the South, her scenes were cut out. So she had to be filmed separately. So she never had roles. She just had moments in movies.
Why don't you explain how that worked when they cut out parts that she was in,
yes,
in the South, like in Words and Music, which
yes,
was
they would cut
the
out
movie biography of Rodgers and
yes,
Hart.
Yes, they would cut out The Lady is a Tramp, which she sang in it. They would just snip it out, take scissors and snip, snip, when it got south the Mason-Dixon line.
So she couldn't be in anything that furthered the plot.
No, she could never be in anything that furthered the plot or was crucial to a no, it was a crucial moment in the movie, never.
She must have been very frustrated.
She must have been.
Did she ever talk to you about that?
She only talked about it when she did her show, funnily enough. Finally. She compensated by making a very hugely successful nightclub career and a very successful career in Europe. And that was what she did.
Did MGM want to keep your mother under contract since they weren't giving her...
Well,
kind of
yeah,
that,
you know why they did.
For.
Yeah, they did because she was very key to the Lowe's vaudeville key chains. They owned a lot of theaters, and she would play those theaters, the Capitol in New York. Whatever they were, they don't exist anymore. So she was good for their image. We're not racist. We have Lena Horne. She was there. So they could never be accused of racism.
She really got it from all sides.
She did. She did. But I think the forerunners always do. Look at Paul. Look at Jackie Robinson.
Why did she leave Hollywood? Did the contract run out?
I think she just sort of got fed up and wanted to get away. And also, she wanted to get married, and they couldn't marry in Hollywood. It was illegal for blacks and whites to marry in 1946. And she had a big fight with MGM in 1946 because they wanted her to be in a musical called St. Louis Woman, which had a wonderful score by Harold Arlen. And she sort of really wanted to do it, and MGM was backing it. But once again, she listened to the NAACP and Walter White, who said, don't do it, it's a demeaning role, which I think in this case was a mistake.
Why?
Well, because it was a great score. It was, she would have played a prostitute. I mean, you know, so what? It was on the stage. And it was, you know, it was, I think it would have been a great career opportunity for her to have been earlier on Broadway than she was.
Did she feel as strongly about the politics of the roles as the people who were advising her did?
I think she felt so strongly about it. I think her respect for them was probably as great as her feelings. I think she was very torn in the St. Louis Woman incident. But I think she was very politicized, and Paul was very much a mentor, and Walter White. So I think she probably felt nearly as strongly.
When your mother married Lenny Hayton, he white, she black, it was illegal.
Yes.
At the time. Did they explain that to you?
They didn't say it was illegal. They said they were getting married and it was a secret. That was all they said to me.
Would they tell you why you couldn't tell anybody?
No, they just said, don't tell anybody. And then, I was about 10 years old, so by 3 years later, when it was no longer a secret, I totally understood why.
Did that mean that you were moving more into the white world once that marriage
happened? Yes, it did. We were out of the black world. We were out of the ordinary white world. We were into that world, and it was white. It was the international celebrity world.
Your family spent a lot of time in Europe.
Yeah.
Was that for political and racial
reasons?
Yeah,
it was because, yes, it was to avoid the blacklisting. And my mother was blacklisted from TV for a while. And so we were in Europe most of the 50s. I mean, every summer we'd be in Europe.
During this period, she became very popular in nightclubs.
Yeah.
But you say that she really hated nightclubs.
Hated nightclubs.
Why?
Well, because usually they were run by the mob. And She considered most of her bosses to be very unsavory characters. She hated the audiences in Las Vegas. She hated everything about Las Vegas, but she made a lot of money. And in those days, Las Vegas, a mecca for huge stars. And you didn't get little old ladies getting off of buses. You got more sort of serious gambling people. And she did hate it. She always said, I hate show business.
She was doing some TV then, too.
Yeah, she was doing a bit, but not a lot. No blacks had their own show when she wanted to have her shows.
Were there things that she couldn't do when performing with white people on TV?
You weren't meant to touch a white performer. A white performer wasn't meant to touch a black performer on television in the 50s. And Perry Como, there were certain people who always, Perry Como always took her arm or always put his arm around her. There were certain people who consciously flaunted the unwritten rule of no blacks and whites touching on television.
Gail Lumet Buckley speaking with Terry Gross, recorded in 1986. Buckley's written for the Los Angeles Times, Vogue, and the New York Times. Buckley's mother, Lena Horne, died Sunday in New York at the age of 92. Here's Lena Horne singing her signature song, recorded in 1941. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Don't know why there's no sun up in the sky. Stormy weather since my man and I ain't together. Keeps raining all the time. Life is bare, gloom and misery everywhere. Stormy weather just can't get my poor self together. I'm weary all the time.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from LendingTree, committed to helping people control their financial destiny with innovative tools and personalized advice at LendingTree.com. From the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day at wallacefoundation.org. And from Barnes & Noble, presenting the Nook e-reader, which offers wireless access to the Barnes & Noble e-book store, in stores and at nook.com. This is NPR.
Coming up, Woody Harrelson on acting, breaking rules, and getting relationship advice from Larry Flint. Harrelson played the porn magazine publisher in the film The People vs. Larry Flint. Harrelson's latest film, The Messenger, comes out on DVD Tuesday. Also, David Edelstein reviews the new film Mother and Child, which stars Annette Bening, Naomi Watts, and Kerry Washington as women whose lives are changed by an adoption. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, in for Terry Gross. Our next guest is actor Woody Harrelson. He first became known for his role in the long-running TV series Cheers. After Cheers, Harrelson concentrated on films, including Natural Born Killers, The People vs. Larry Flint, and No Country for Old Men. Last year, Harrelson earned an Oscar nomination for his role in The Messenger. It's out on DVD next week. In The Messenger, Harrelson and Ben Foster co-star as Army Casualty Notification Officers, those assigned to visit family members and tell them their loved one has died in combat. I spoke to Harrelson last year when The Messenger was released. In this clip from the film, Harrelson is Captain Tony Stone, a veteran of casualty notification. He's instructing Foster's character, Staff Sergeant Will Montgomery, who's new to the assignment, explaining what is and isn't done when delivering the tragic news of a combat death.
You do not speak with anybody other than the next of kin. No friend, no neighbor, no co-worker or mistress. Hours of operation are 0600 to 2200 hours. We don't want to wake anybody up in the middle of the night. Though if you ask me, hitting them with the news at the crack of dawn is not exactly a great way to start their day, breakfast-wise.
What do we do if the next of kin isn't around?
We leave. We don't wait. We don't lurk. We come back later. This is a zero-defect mission, a pure hit-and-get operation.
Is that it, sir?
One more thing. You do not touch the NOK. Avoid physical contact with the next of kin, unless it's a medical emergency, like if they are having a heart attack or something. You are representing the Secretary of the Army, not Will Montgomery, so in case you feel like offering a hug or something, don't. It'll only get you in trouble.
Woody Harrelson, welcome to Fresh Air. You know, I don't remember you playing a soldier a lot in the past. Could talk a little about getting into the character of Captain Tony Stone? I mean, the physical transformation, the way you carry yourself as an Army captain?
A lot of it has to do with Orrin Moverman, the director. He really helped me because, for one thing, he was in the Israeli military for a while, and he has a familiarity with the military. And honestly, as I told Orrin, there's really two particular occupations I thought I could never play, one being a soldier and the other being a policeman, just because I just don't feel like, I don't know what it is, maybe it's something to do with authority or something, but so this one I was really nervous about, and I only had a few days prep. Part of what helped me was Orrin sent, you know, some backstory to the character, because, you know, otherwise I didn't feel like I had enough time to just use my imagination and try to figure it out. So luckily he sent me some pages of backstory to help me think in terms of Tony Stone. He sent me with my Class A's and my fatigue, so I'm marching around Bucharest in my boots and, you know, probably an odd sight, but...
And you shaved your head for this role, right?
And yeah, he asked me to shave my head, so yeah, I did that. And I mean, just the most, in reading a book, Tim O'Brien's The Things They Carry really helped. And, you know, there were a lot of things, but nothing really helped as much as just spending time with the soldiers. I felt like that really helped me. It humanized them in such a way that I felt like, oh, you know, they're not that much different from me, you know, so.
And this character of yours is also carrying some personal baggage. He's a reformed alcoholic, kind of hiding from the pain in his life and maybe that which he is bringing to these loved ones.
Yeah, I think that's true. He's got a lot of pain and rage inside of him and, you know, kind of keeps it all under wraps when he goes and does his notifications. But during the course of the film, we get to know him a little better through Ben Foster's character, Will Montgomery, and who's also kind of a stoic guy who it takes a lot to get underneath his emotions. And that's one of the beauties of the way this movie was made, because you really come to know both of these characters in a slow but very effective way. And they really come to love each other. It's an unlikely friendship that develops.
Right, and there's sort of a hard-bitten exterior that they both put on. And then they have to go into some of the most emotionally wrenching circumstances any of us will ever have to in notifying these loved ones of the death of a serviceman. And, you know, as I thought about this, it occurred to me that all of us know what it's like to have a phone call that we dread, you know, to break up with a boyfriend or girlfriend or deliver uncomfortable news to somebody we know. These people who do this job have to walk up and deliver this life-shattering news to a total stranger. And I'm wondering, as you played that, where you get out of the car with Ben Foster and you're walking up to these people, are you thinking about how you steel yourself for that kind of an experience?
Yeah, everything in on the set was kind of perfectly laid out to make it the best or the realest possible experience. You know, it was shot with one camera, one take. We didn't meet the people ahead of time who we were doing the scene with. We didn't arrange it or block it or rehearse it. So we did all have the dialogue, but inside of that, there was still a lot of unpredictable things. And emotionally, it was very charged. And even if sometimes I didn't feel connected emotionally, Ben Foster would show me, pictures of some of the young men and women who had served and been killed in action. And it would just immediately, the emotion of it would come flooding back. And the actors we were with were phenomenal. So they really made it an emotional experience.
So these, if I understand this correctly, there was no rehearsal. You were going up to people you had literally never seen before, as if you were carrying this news, and then you encountered their reactions.
Yeah, I mean, there were six notifications. Two of them were, Samantha Morton and Steve Buscemi, so we had seen them before, but we didn't see them before doing this, and we didn't, I'd never met Samantha Morton, so... I think that it was a good way to do it, but it was, intense.
Actor Woody Harrelson, his film The Messenger is out on DVD next week. More after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Our guest is actor Woody Harrelson. He earned an Oscar nomination for his film The Messenger. It's out on DVD next week. Here's his first appearance on the TV series Cheers.
Woody, did you say you're looking for work?
Well, actually, I came to Boston on a fact-finding tour. See, I tend bar back home in Indiana. Well, it's not a bar exactly. It's more like a pigsty with a jukebox. If we had a jukebox.
I'd like you to meet Woody Boyd. Woody, this is Carla Tortelli.
Hi, ma'am.
Ma'am? What's that supposed to mean?
I believe it's a term of respect.
I wonder it sounded so weird.
The character that you played, Woody Boyd, was sort of this lovable, naive hayseed from Indiana. And, it occurred to me that you got this huge role at a pretty early time in your acting career. Not like you didn't pay some dues. I know that you did, plays in New York, but you had a lot more success in your 20s than a lot of people did. And I'm wondering if being in Hollywood then, you grew up in Ohio, I guess, and playing
Texas and Ohio.
Texas and Ohio, right. And that being in Hollywood then and having that role, were you a little wide-eyed like Woody Boyd?
Yeah, I suppose I was. I was, I just turned 24 when they started. I was 23 when I auditioned for it, but it was right just before my birthday. And then, I don't know, doing it, I got to say, I didn't have the full realization of, I'm replacing this beloved character. I mean, I kind of knew that, but I hadn't watched the show, so I didn't really know that much. I think it would have been a lot more of a daunting task had I been watching the show. But certainly, I remember standing back off stage waiting for that red light to go on, and, I could hear the dialogue, and I could tell it was getting closer, and then, boom, the red light goes on, and I'm entering into the bar in front of a live audience, and obviously a show that's going to be seen by a lot of people. So it was pretty... I was nervous, I gotta say, but thankfully, I'd done enough theater in college that I think it really helped me get through that.
After Cheers, you made a transition to movies in a way that not that many TV actors do as successfully. And one of your early films was White Men Can't Jump, and I thought we'd listen to that. I think it really put you on the map as a movie actor, and I thought we would listen to a clip from that. And this is you and your co-star Wesley Snipes. I mean, those who know the film know that you guys are basketball hustlers. You go onto playground and provoke games and fool people and take their money. And in this scene, you're about to compete with Wesley as a partner in a two-on-two basketball tournament, and you suddenly start talking trash to a couple of guys on the court whom you might have to play later. Let's listen.
Hey, chump. Yeah, you, potato head. You know who I'm talking about. Is that the best game you got? Because if it is, you better just grab that free T-shirt and head home.
Yeah, man, what the hell are you doing, man?
You hit, who'd you bring over here? Mighty Mouse? You're too pretty to play basketball. You know that? You got that big Z in your fro, man.
Come on, would you stop already?
Hey, man, what are you, the Black Zorro?
Oh, man, look, that's enough.
Hey, no, seriously, you get your hair cut at the Braille Institute?
What the f*** is Opie Taylor talking about anyway, huh?
Opie Taylor? Opie, hey, I got your Opie, you big, bad, Gomer Pop, droopy-eyed son of a bitch.
You and the cream and wheat man, take your ass back to Mayberry and tell Aunt B she better have my bean pies or I'm going to kick her ass.
What are you doing? Lurching more kiss ya?
What are you doing?
Hey, I'm doing two things.
What? What are you doing?
I'm making them mad. Most guys don't play good when they're mad.
Look, you know you're embarrassing me. That's what you're doing.
Yeah, well, that's the other thing I'm doing.
You know, you're not embarrassing me. You are pissing me off. That's what you're doing.
Well, good, because unlike those guys, I assume you play better when you're mad. Am I right?
I'm not listening to you.
Yeah, but you are hearing me.
And that is my guest, Woody Harrelson, with Wesley Snipes from the movie White Men Can't Jump. A lot of fun macho trash talk there. But you know, a character really different from Woody Boyd on Cheers. And, you know, I have to say, when I think of a Woody Harrelson role, what I think of is a guy who brings enormous self-confidence, just not a moment of self-doubt. I mean, the kind of guy that could start trash talking on the basketball court. Is that closer to you than this naive kid from Cheers?
You know, maybe somewhere right in the middle. I don't feel as confident as that. I don't remember. Well, I guess I do some trash talking, but I feel a lot like that character, Billy Hoyle. Yeah, I guess so.
Well, let's talk a little bit about The People versus Larry Flint. This was a role that got you an Oscar nomination. I mean, Larry Flint was, of course, the publisher of Hustler magazine, who was shot and paralyzed from the waist down. I believe the assailant was never actually caught. And you played him in this film about his battles against censorship, as well as it's, you know, a profile of his very interesting life. I thought we should listen to a cut here. In a way, you kind of had two. There were sort of two roles here. I mean, you had to play the Larry Flint before he was injured, and the one after. And the one after, the gunshot wounds affected his speech. And in this cut from the film, you've just come back to Hustler magazine after being either in jail for contempt in one of the court cases or in the hospital. I'm not sure which, but you've come back to the magazine and sort of taken charge. Let's listen.
The pervert is back.
Circulation is down by a third. Color reproduction is horrible. Models look like they're $3 whores. The writing is by some moronic idiots.
Mr. Flint, I don't want to step on your toes, but things have changed since you were actively running the company. I mean, I look back at the stuff you did in the 70s, and it was sort of racy and crazy. But the country's different now. Reagan has rebuilt America, and the moral majority is gaining power.
You're fired.
Excuse me?
You get the f*** out of my building, Doug! Get him out of here! Need to blow dry jerk.
Bye-bye.
Take them out of here, throw them in the incinerator, cut them to little pieces, and feed them to the animals out there. Get out of here!
There! Larry, you can't do that. I mean, he's our vice president. He's the VP of marketing.
Hey, Jimbo, are you trying to challenge my authority? You see that on the wall? LFP. That's Larry Flint Publication. Not JFP. Okay, I'm the big kahuna here. Do you have a problem with that?
No, Larry. You're the boss.
So, Larry, what's the plan?
The plan is simple. The establishment took my manhood from me, but they left half of me. They left the half with the brain, and I'm going to use it to get back.
And that's my guest, Woody Harrelson, making his mark as Larry Flint, the porn publisher, in the film The People Versus Larry Flint. Tell us, what interested you about doing this film?
Well, you know, when they offered it to me, I was, I kind of had a similar opinion most people had, which when they heard it, they said, well, why would you want to do a movie about this guy? And yet, you know, they were, and Milos Forman was going to direct it, so it really seemed like something you got to pay attention to. So I went and met with Larry, and my feeling was if I didn't like him, I just wasn't going to play the part. But I was kind of amazed by him. You know, he's a brilliantly funny, interesting guy who likes to stir things up, and yet, you know, whether or not you agree with what he does, he's a kind of a fascinating character. So I was glad to get time with him. And then when we started to make it, there was a lot of work to be done because the script just needed a lot of work. And there ended up being a lot of improv in it. And that was fun listening to that scene because that was my brother in that scene. He played Jimmy Flint.
Do you identify with Larry Flint in any way? I mean, you're both people who sort of aren't afraid of stirring things up and setting your own course.
Well, I think probably during the course of it, he kind of activated me more. Just for having played him, it made me, you know, it was after that that I did things where I had brushes with the law and so forth that, you know, probably I never would have done that.
Maybe you should explain what you mean by brushes with the law.
Well, for example, I was upset by the fact that there was no distinction made between hemp and marijuana, where I think in a free country you should be free to grow whatever, but I'm not going to pretend this is a free country. But however, I went to Kentucky, and along with my buddy Joe Hickey there, we kind of set up this thing where I planted hemp seeds and got arrested. And then the concept of it was to go to trial, which we ultimately did, and hopefully the jury would see the distinction between the two, and our, you know, farmers would be free to grow hemp, which you can use for paper or clothing, or, you know, it's a sustainable material. So that's what ended up happening. And doing things like that or climbing the Golden Gate Bridge, I don't know if I ever would have done that kind of thing had I not played Larry, just because it made me look at things differently. Before, the thought of getting arrested was just an impossible thought, and I would never intentionally do that. And after playing the part, I looked at it as a way to kind of get my point across, you know.
I read, too, that there was a time when you were having a rough time with Laura Louie, your wife, although then I guess you weren't married. And you spoke to Larry about it, and I think he even might have spoken to her.
Yeah, Larry took it upon himself, unbeknownst to me, and called up Laura and got together with her and actually was giving relationship advice because I guess he considered her, you know, being my wife comparable to what it would be like to be Larry's wife. I'm not sure why. But it was one of those incredible, you know, things a true friend does, you know, that you just, I was really grateful for that. And I think it did help.
We're about out of time. But Woody Harrelson, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure being on your show.
Woody Harrelson recorded last year when his film The Messenger was released. It's out on DVD next week. Coming up, David Edelstein on the new film Mother and Child. This is Fresh Air. The new film Mother and Child stars Annette Bening as a woman who gave birth to a daughter at age 14 and gave her up for adoption. Naomi Watts plays that daughter 37 years later, and Kerry Washington is a young woman who can't conceive and longs to adopt a child of her own. Written and directed by Rodrigo Garcia, the film is about how their paths unexpectedly cross or don't. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
Director and screenwriter Rodrigo Garcia has few peers when it comes to direct, up-close psychological realism. You study the faces of his characters and see their defenses at work, layer under layer of them, shifting this and that way like tectonic plates. That Garcia is the son of Gabriel Garcia Marquez interests me largely because of how clearly he staked out his own territory at the other end from his father's overflowing historical novels full of magical realism. Garcia goes for the microscopic instead of the macroscopic. His 2005 film Nine Lives consists of nine single shots, each a long and sinuous portrait of a different woman's epiphany in real time. A segment with Robin Wright Penn is the most remarkable. She's hugely pregnant and pushing a shopping cart when she meets an old boyfriend, her true love, and there's no cutaway as she moves through the aisles as her inner world crumbles. Mother and Child is Garcia's latest triumph and his most formally daring. It's not a fully unified piece of storytelling. It's three short stories that finally intersect, although not in any way we can predict. But among them are echoes, cross-currents, profound variations on the theme of mothers and children, largely mothers and daughters. The movie is so painful so quickly. A 14-year-old girl is seen smooching with a boy and taking off her shirt, then caressing her big round belly, then screaming as her baby is born and carried off. In the next shot, that teenage girl is a brittle, haggard Annette Bening, unmarried and childless in her early 50s, living with her elderly mother. She'll be 37, she says aloud, of the daughter she has never known. In the next scene, a chillingly poised 37-year-old lawyer, played by Naomi Watts, tells her prospective employer, Samuel L. Jackson, about herself.
If you wouldn't mind, could you give me some of your personal background?
I was born here in Los Angeles, and I was given up for adoption on the day of my birth. My mother was 14 when she had me, and that's all I know about her. My adoptive father died when I was 10. My adoptive mother and I are not close. My name, Elizabeth Joyce, is one I picked out for myself in junior high. It's my legal name now. I don't go by any other. I live alone. I have since I turned 17. I've never been married, and I have no plans to marry. I value my independence above all things. That way I don't have any expectations to fulfill other than my own, which are great enough.
Less than 10 minutes into Mother and Child, we feel in our bones how the adoption of this baby girl was brutally consequential for everyone. The entire film is suffused with that loss. It's also suffused with compassion, insight, empathy, and from time to time, hilarity. That's because Annette Bening creates a tapestry of tics and tremors and false declarations of strength followed by utter collapse that's both clownish and emotionally true. A cup of coffee with a coworker who wants to get to know her, a teddy bear widower played by Jimmy Smits, is a psychocomic hoot that builds to a bad end.
What else would you like to know?
We don't have to interrogate each other. This is not a date.
Interrogate's a harsh word. You live by yourself?
No. What's so funny?
No, nothing. I just can't seem to say the right things around you, and I'm trying, believe me.
What do you mean?
I just feel like I keep putting my foot in my mouth every time I talk to you, and I just don't know why. Look, I'm sorry. Let's forget I said that. I don't know what I'm talking about.
I'm not a difficult person.
No, I don't mean that.
Now, you're not comfortable with me.
No, I am.
My words are too harsh.
No.
The third protagonist of Mother and Child, after Benning and Watts, is a young African-American woman played with a wonderful Mary Tyler Moore-ish giddiness by Kerry Washington. She can't have children and undergoes a grueling grilling by a pregnant teenager played by Sharika Epps to see if she's worthy of adopting the girl's child. There are more characters, more subplots, each adding something new to Garcia's structure. Characters wrestle with either the overbearing presence or the overbearing absence of a mother. The strands come together at an adoption agency run by a beatific nun played by Cherry Jones, her persistent faith a counterpoint to the grim world outside her doors. Mother and Child is, there's no getting around it, devastating. But it's the best, the fullest, the most life-affirming pain I've felt at a movie in years.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Melody Kramer is our associate producer of digital media. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Angie's List, providing consumer reviews on local professionals, from physicians and veterinarians to plumbers and roofers. Details at angieslist.com. From the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world, on the web at hewlett.org. And from Broadway Books, publisher of Every Day in Tuscany, the sequel to Under the Tuscan Sun by Francis Mays, available in bookstores and online. This is NPR.
I'm singing in the rain.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Philip Fury about his book, The Songs of Hollywood. Also, 85 million bottles of water a day are sold in the U.S. What's in them, and why do we drink it? We talk with Peter Glick, author of Bottled and Sold. Join us.
Dark up above, the sun's in my heart, and I'm ready for love.